Sometimes it's easier to talk to a stranger than it is to talk to your own loved ones. I always tell people, it's always good to have a plan, because you don't want to need a plan and not have a plan when it's too late. As you get older, I'm talking to all of y'all, as your parents get older, these are conversations that you want to have with them about what their wishes are, what they want when the time comes for them, if at any time that they're not able to speak for themselves, to make decisions for themselves. If you're married, you need to have that conversation with your spouse. You need to have that conversation with your spouse about your children. Because you want to have the decision kind of formulated and have a plan before something happens and you're forced to make that decision and you're just not emotionally, don't have that equipment. Culture comes into a lot of play when we talk about end of life and terminal illnesses. And, you know, some people feel like we just need to do everything to keep the patient alive. And sometimes we might put our, or we, at the opposite end, we might say, this patient is just suffering so much. Why does this family just continue? Well, there's culture, there's family dynamics, there's a lot of things in play that we don't know about. So we as nurses have to, we're advocates for our patient, we're advocates for our patient's families. There's also the laws that we have to abide by as well. Right, so without further ado, let's talk about end of life care. These are just some objectives I want you to think about, kind of our goals when we talk about end of life care. Some of the things that you as nurses, particularly those of you who are going to work in the emergency room and with trauma, level one traumas, a lot of decisions get made, a lot of decisions don't get made, find yourselves in situations where, you know, organ donation, was the patient, you know, did they wish to be an organ donor? What happens when the family comes in and says, oh no, they're taking all of their organs with them, even though they had it expressed, it's on their driver's license, you know, and that's what they, and they had expressed interest, that's what their desire was. But if they haven't had that conversation with their family member, then that family member most likely will override it. And there's basically nothing you can do. It may take a little while, maybe. And time is of the essence when a person is, you know, has got brain damage. But I don't know if you know how much you know about the donation program in LOPA. Usually they would, typically in every orientation I've ever been to, the organ donation representative for the state, for that region, will come in and give a talk. But you will, as your patient, you will have contact with LOPA every time you have a patient that dies, whether they were a donor or not. It's just, it's a standard. All right, so your end-of-life care, it's an essential part of your nursing practice. And it's changed. When I started working as a nurse in 1984, hospice was something new. Palliative care as a specialty didn't really exist. Hospice was something that hadn't really taken off as far as home care, where people could be taken care of at home. But now there's a hospice. There's various hospices all over town. It used to be the hospices were basically within the healthcare system. Like a Little Knighton had a hospice and Christus had a hospice. with like the within the system, but now you have independent hospices just all over the place. And they take care of not just the physical needs of the patient, but they also take care of this, the emotional, the social, the psychosocial, the family dynamics come into play. I didn't have a lot of experience with hospice for most of my career until my family needed it, and then I learned a lot. And so I've had both of my parents have been hospice patients, and I can tell you that it made all the difference in the world. I didn't think I could ever work in a hospice situation, even though I worked in the ER and been a bedside nurse for years. But now I think that if I didn't do this, that would probably be where I'd want to go, would be a hospice nurse. Like I said, in palliative care, we address the spiritual and the religious and the cultural aspects of care. All that's taken into consideration. And hospice nurses, depending on the community where they live or where they work, there's different cultures. You know, America is a melting pot, and you may have a very high Native American population where you live. You may have a very high Hispanic population where you live, or an Asian population, and I guarantee you the three of them do not view death and dying the same way. Right? A Catholic is not going to view death and dying the same way as a Buddhist or a Hindu views it. And remember, there are some legal and ethical aspects of what we do. So the goal here is to realize that you are the advocate for your patient, and you support and you give information. You don't advise. When you hear the thing, well, what do you think we ought to do? You know, that's never something that we tell them, right? That's a decision that they as a family and the individual has to make on their own. But we give them the information that they need to make an informed decision. So, Dying in America, out of the Institute of Medicine, improving the quality and honoring individual preferences near the end of life, is a document that was written due to the fragmented care in the social perceptions of death and dying. Death is, you all realize, a natural form of life, right? You all have an expiration date. You just don't know what that date is, right? Some of you will have a very long life. Some of you and people you know may not. You always kind of have to psychically get yourself, you know, prepared. You as nurses will see death a lot. I mean, how much death did the world see in 2020? It was ever present every day. And how many stories do we know of people that had the COVID or because of COVID, their loved ones weren't with them? You know, families who have family members in the nursing homes like we did. We weren't allowed to see my mom for months, you know, until the end, and we were able to be with her. Not even the hospice nurses were allowed to go in and see her like they had been on a regular basis. We had to depend on, you know, the nursing home. Hospitals, families had to depend on a hospital. So nurses and healthcare staff for the year 2020 have done more with dealing with death and dying and having to deal with that, things that they've never had to deal with before. So when you're out there in the clinical setting and your nurses seem to be a little apathetic, a little burned out, it's because they are. And that's because they've been having to do more of this than they have. This used to be just hospice nurses, right? And palliative care nurses. And all of a sudden now it was all the nurses, the specialized COVID nurses. So my point is, we all have this job, right? It's not just for the specialized hospice and palliative care. These patients are going to be If you work on oncology, if you work in transplant, if you work in orthopedics, at any given time, you can have a patient that's terminal or, you know, they have to make these tough decisions. Anyway, so the recommendations that have been for improving life of care is having a widespread access so that more people have access to these kinds of care, be it hospice, be it specialized in setting. You can have palliative care. I've only worked in one place that actually had a palliative care department, and that was in Alexandria, and there was a doctor, her specialty was palliative care, and she had nurse practitioners. And what they would do is they would go throughout the hospital as they were consulted and see their patients and make recommendations for the kind of medications and interventions that they would have. They also might recommend that they go to an inpatient hospice, which the hospital facility also had at that time. So that you could be able, if you wanted to be at home, if your family says, I can't handle this, then they would have you, you could come to the hospital. If you were in the nursing home, you didn't have to leave the nursing home to go be in the hospice. The hospice nurses, because the nursing home is your home, right? So they would go to the nursing home. And sometimes it can just take place in the hospital. Communication between providers. Having health, nurses are the ones typically will communicate the most effectively with the patients, right? They're the ones that the patient's families are going to talk to more honestly if you invite them to, if you make yourself available to them, then since they are to their doctor. But by improving this, by having this palliative care and having these options, then the primary care providers are more likely to encourage patients to think about this and family members to think about this when the time comes. Okay? Planning. That's what I started off with, right? You need to have that conversation early, and you want to have, documents. One of the things you're going to ask your patient, how many times have you been in the hospital lately? And they said, do you have an advance directive? Do you have a living will? Do you have a power of attorney? We're supposed to have all these. There was a time when we were doing admissions, and we had to give them this document and encourage them to do this. Now, I didn't agree that the time to ask somebody if you had a living will or an advance directive was when they came in, and in 12 hours they were going to have open heart surgery. This is something that they needed to think about prior to having open heart surgery. They were already nervous, right? And I was like, okay, so it took me a bit to accept the fact that I'm going to have my chest opened and get new arteries and all that. And now you're telling me there's a possibility I might die and I got to make this decision now? So that's where planning is key. Have your patients should have this. These conversations should take place in the doctor's offices, right? When they're when they're seeing their patients doing their history physicals. So y'all remember back in level one when you were doing health assessment? What was part of the health assessment? Do you have a living will? Do you have an advance directive? All right, education of the public and recognizing the role of the family member, all right? Those of us who are caregivers, we need to be a part of the process, because if your patient is on hospice because they have dementia, how much do you think the patient's even going to be involved in the whole process, all right? So they need to know about the medications. They need to know. They need to become, everybody tells them they all become mini nurses when they become a caregiver, because they have to know all of these things. They have to be PT and OT and nurse and CNA and doctor. They have to be in respiratory therapist. They have to do it all, right? At home, which may or may not be in the best of conditions. They have to work with what they've got. I like this about awareness context, even though it's really old, but there's four types of awareness. There's closed awareness, suspected awareness, mutual pretense awareness, and then there's open awareness. Open awareness, as you can imagine, is the goal, right? When you look at the definition of the of the other three. Like, the patient's unaware of his or her terminal state, but everybody else knows about it. So they're all talking about the patient in the hall, and the patient doesn't even know about it. Like, all these decisions are being made. Is this a good thing?
No.
Would you want this for you? No. Of course not. The only person that this would even is for the dementia patient. And even the dementia patient needs to be treated as if they have some level of understanding. Suspected awareness is your patient suspects what others know and attempts to find out the details. I know I'm dying. You know you're dying? Let's talk about it. Mutual pretense awareness, the patient, the family, and the healthcare team are all aware, but everyone pretends differently. So nobody wants to talk about it. When do you think the time to talk about it is? When you know that your patient's not going to get any better. When you know that the end is, I've never known how they could put a time on it, you know, but they can apparently. Awareness that everybody's aware and they're openly acknowledge the reality. Having been through this not once but twice with both my parents, I can honestly tell you, and yes, I'm a healthcare worker. Would it have been any different for me if I weren't a healthcare worker? Absolutely. I know this because I watched everybody else in my family, how they dealt with it, because they're not, right? I got a bunch of educators, I got computer people, I got laborers, I have absolutely no healthcare worker. I was the only healthcare worker in my immediate family. So what ends up happening? I take the professional caregiver role. So I didn't get to have all that, I need to have the emotional. I had to be always decision-making because I was the healthcare person. Whereas they got to not have to deal with those kinds of things. But I didn't see things from their side either. I couldn't understand why they couldn't see what was going on and why they wanted to make the decisions that they made was because they didn't understand. So I can say even in our own situation, we didn't really, although we talked about what we felt was best, we didn't really, weren't always on the same page. All right, the legislative issues, okay. Legally, in the state of Louisiana, we don't do assisted suicide. Let me just say that right here. Anybody know why we probably don't do assisted suicide in Louisiana? Anybody know anything about our law, our constitution? Do you know what the Napoleonic Code is? We still operate on the Napoleonic Code. So, you know, we were a very Catholic state. And so, okay, hold on a second. There, ATI is being done. Hang on a second. So sometimes it gets very confusing. What's an advance directive? What's a living will? What's a proxy? But we're Catholic. So basically when you're in a Catholic state, and Catholic is all about the right life. So that was why assisted suicide was probably never going to be. And then it's just something that's something that they've never done. So whereas you got other states where they do have assisted. And it's very, very rigid criteria. It's not just, I don't want to live anymore, help me kill myself. That's not like that. There's a very, very defined situation that it's allowed. It's not just willy-nilly. Anyway, so the advanced directives, this is what you should really understand. You've got a DNR, a DNI, and a chemical code, which you got to clarify. Doesn't mean it's withhold standard care. All right, DNR, do not resuscitate. I do not want you to do what? Do not give me CPR. Deonite, do not intubate. I do not want you to.
Intubate me.
But you can. You can chest compressions, rescue breathing, and you can give me medications, right? Mm-hmm. Chemical cut. What can you do with a chemical cut? Only medications, right? Did I hit record? I don't think I did. Oh, my bad. Okay. Go back and say this again. Is it recording now?
Mm-hmm.
Is it recording?
Yes.
Okay, it's recording. All right. So, DNR is do not resuscitate. DNI, do not intubate with chemical code. So, if I want a chemical code, can y'all still hear me? Hey, Nakas, can you still hear me if I walk around?
If you don't get too far, we'll be able to hear you. I'll let you know if we can't.
Okay. All right. So, no chest compressions, no breathing, no intubation, no drugs, DNR. Chest compression, drugs, no intubation, DNI. No chest compressions, no rescue breathing. Well, you can do rescue breathing. No chest compressions, no intubation, but you can give them all the drugs in a chemical coat, okay? And it has to be in writing, and it has to be on the chart. And if it's not on the chart, guess what? You got to do a DNR. So it's always it's a very important thing as a part of the admission process, is that the admission nurse, it's in big red letters. You know, do not, DNR, DNI, chemical code, full code. And it says the advance directives are the written documents that allow a competent person to document their preferences regarding. All right, so the minute we knew that my mom was going to have issues, that was not when we discussed it. We started discussing my mom's status when my mom was in her 70s and not even so. She always said, you will not do this to me. She says, you're not good. Do not do chest compressions. Do not intubate me. Do not do anything. I'm 77 years old. I've lived a good life. Let me go. This was all after my father passed away, and she had watched what he had gone through. He had lymphoma. Okay. And she said, and leukemia, she said, I don't ever want to go through that. So she had already made her mind up. And so it was probably another 3 or 4 more years where we did a power of attorney. She had already had an advance directive in her doctor's office. My father had made this very same decision when he had cancer, that I'm done. When the treatment no longer works, I'm done. Don't do anything else. Just let me go. And a lot of people of what I call the greatest generation, their childhood was the Depression. Their young adulthood was World War II. You know, they could withstand anything that generation could. Most of them. There are a population that's passing now, and these are the decisions they make. It's like, I'm good, I'm going to go. But you have other people that know I want you to do everything for me. And when you ask them in the hospital, that's what they're going to say. I want you to do everything for me. When they're out thinking about it, and when they don't do anything about it, is when they say, you know, I really don't want to go through all that. I really don't. You know, I'm tired of being sick. I'm sick and tired of being sick. And I'm ready to go. I don't want them to do all that when it's my time. So that's why we encourage patients to have these documents on file somewhere. And it'll be a part of your admission when you're a nurse, right? A living will is an advance directive, okay? But kind of like the advance directive is the umbrella. Do you have an advance directive? What is it? Okay, my advance directive is a document in my doctor's office that says, under these circumstances, this is what I want done. Under these circumstances, this is what I don't want done. The proxy directive, or the power of attorney, is when the time comes, and I can't speak for myself, she's going to speak for me. We've had this conversation. She knows what I want. It doesn't matter that she's not my daughter, she's not my son, she's not my husband, but she's my friend. And I know then in an emotional situation, she's going to be clear-headed and she's going to make the decisions that I want made. They're too emotionally involved. They think about what they're losing and not really thinking about what I don't want to have to go through. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So sometimes it may not be the family member that's doing it. If it's a mother or a younger person. So I was my mother's, for her. I made all her decisions. All right, I got ahead of myself. About the assisted suicide legislation, it is allowed in California, Colorado, Washington, D.C., Hawaii, Maine, New Jersey, Oregon, Vermont, and Washington. And they're death with dignity statutes. Now you'll see that two physicians must confirm the patient's residency, right? You wake up yesterday and go, I'm going to go live in Washington, D.C. because I'm terminal and I want to have assisted suicide. No, I should have already been living in Washington, D.C. for a certain amount of time before I'm considered legal. The diagnosis, the prognosis, the mental competence, and the voluntariness of the request. Two physicians. Two waiting periods. The first between the oral request and the second between receiving and filling the prescription are required. This all stems from the idea that the terminally ill people, not the government, religious leaders, or politicians, determine death with dignity. The statutes allow mentally competent adult state residents who have a terminal illness with a confirmed prognosis of fewer, 6 months or fewer, to live in voluntary request and receive a prescription medication to hasten their inevitable and imminent death. The State Nurse Practice Act, nurses should be well informed and able to respond to their patients' questions about legal options that might permit patient control of dying in their state. These numbers are here, this is because it's referred from something else referenced. Student nurses must respect the patient's right to request aid in dying, number one. Number two, nurses must be knowledgeable of the law regarding aid in dying of the state or territory in which you practice. So, can you do it in Louisiana? Mm-hmm. But if you move to California, you can. So don't be surprised if that happens, okay? While nurses are ethically permitted to participate in aid in dying in states or territories where it's legal, you retain the right to conscientiously object. Meaning, I respect your right to take your life, end your life under your circumstances, but based on my religious belief as a Catholic, I can't be involved. I don't judge you. Mm-hmm. I respect you, but I personally can't take part in it. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So I will go find someone who can. I don't tell them that they can't do it. I don't tell them that they're wrong. That's not my job. I just don't have to compromise my beliefs, my religious beliefs, for her. Okay? So I wouldn't have to take part in it. And some people, religious, that didn't have anything to do. They're just like, I'm just not having a part of someone taking their own life, right? Mm-hmm. And you can understand that. I mean, can you put yourself in that situation? Can you? I mean, it's unfathomable for me to do that. So nurses must be able to provide information and aid on dying and provide emotional support to patients and families who face this decision at the end of life. I will say, now that we know this, if you have, you know someone, and they say, well, what state can I go to? You need to be able to tell them, well, you can't just go on a weekend away trip and say, oh, well, I'm here, could you help me die? You have to tell them, no, you can't do that. You know, there's a very strict criteria that you have to follow. All right, So, here's a question for you. Which awareness context occurs when the family and the patient and the healthcare professionals are aware of the patient's dying and openly acknowledge that? That's a real hard one, huh?
Okay.
Gotta use those context clues, right? Good idea. All right, palliative care. A little bit about palliative care. It's comprehensive care for patients whose disease is not responsive or curative. Right. What falls under that list? Some types of cancer, some heart disease, some lung diseases, right? You can't see COPD for so long and you're walking around on 6 liters of oxygen all the time and you've got no more, your lung compliance is shot and you're spending so much time in with an exacerbation of your COPD that's compounded by your coronary heart disease and your congestive heart failure. You see where I'm going with this? Okay? You're never going to get any better. What about the kidney patient? He's not getting a new patient. He's not getting a new kidney. He goes to dialysis 3 times a week. You're not getting any better. Right? So, what does life look like for you? So, these are the kinds of people that warrant, you know, the dementia patients can do great for a long time. Mom did great for ages, you know, from 87 to almost 96. So it wasn't until after she broke the gift that she actually required the hospice. So, you know, they can go for a long time, but they still fall in the category of this kind of care. Comfort measures with or without curative intent. So the goal is to make them comfortable, right? It's like when you study oncology, there are certain times, sometimes they'll do a surgery for palliative reasons. So it's to make them comfortable. It's appropriate at any stage in a serious illness. We can manage the symptoms. It involves psychosocial care and spiritual needs to enhance what quality of life that person has. But you also include the family. It's very interdisciplinary. There'll be doctors involved. There's always a doctor involved. Acute care nurse practitioners, advanced practice nurses like adult and family nurse practitioners, RNs, pharmacists, chaplains, and the settings can be in hospitals, nursing homes, skilled nursing facilities, at home. I would say this, when my mom began in hospice care and COVID hit, her chaplain called me every 2 weeks to check on me to see how I was doing. You know, he would go and see her, and then he would call me and give me a report, but he would always say, so how are you doing? And it wasn't how are you doing being so far away from your mom and not being able to see her and come visit us. So how are you doing with all this COVID mess? How are you and your family doing? Do you guys need anything? The social worker would call. The nurse would call. They were in constant contact with us as a family the whole entire time that she was in hospice care. And that was even before she went into it, because we lived out of town and could only get there on the weekends. So hospice care is a type of palliative care with life expectancy measured in months and not years. There was a time that they would only cancer patients seem to be put on hospice, but now over time, it's like the dementia patients have been added. Heart failure patients, again, those kinds of conditions where they're not gonna get any better and that over time they're just gonna get worse. So you're not gonna cure a patient's heart failure, are you? You're not gonna cure, you know, their damaged hearts from heart disease. Are you going to add years to their life? Hopefully. Are you going to increase their quality of life? Hopefully. But sometimes, eventually, it's just going to give out. So our goal is to improve the quality of life. Hospice means hope, a host. Hospice is an option in the U.S., but it's not well integrated into healthcare. There were facilities, if you did a study, it's like how many facilities in your area have an in-house hospice? An inpatient hospice. There's probably not that many. Some would have a remote, you know, off-site hospice. I don't think there's even that many anymore. Now it's all of these independent companies that have picked up the hospice torch. Most patients enrolled in hospice in previous decades had cancer. Now only 36.6% of hospice enrollees in 2014 had cancer as a diagnosis. Principles of hospice care says that death should be accepted by the family, by the patient. You're preparing the patient to die. You're preparing the family and the patient for the impending death. It's not just physical. There are psychological and social emotional aspects. There's spiritual aspects. It is an interdisciplinary approach. There will be more than just nurses and CNAs, but like I said, there will be a chaplain. Pain and other symptoms must be managed. Pain is the biggest fear, you know, that of what a cancer patient has, right? Is that when they get to this point, it's, I don't want to be in this kind of pain. And so it's the pain that's managed. There's a lot of rules and regulations about when the patient is at home with the kinds of narcotics that they have, but you have to be very, you have to teach your patients' families about. Bereavement care is provided to most of the families. We are several months out from my mother's death, and I get a card, I get a phone call every once in a while, just checking on me, seeing how I'm doing. And it's a place where we have continuing research and education. So a family is asking why their father with end-stage COPD is being referred to hospice care. The best response from the nurse would be that hospice provides complete pain control. Hospice assists the family and the patient to prepare for death. Hospice will follow the patient's choice for DNR status, or hospice is provided in the home and will allow the family to be involved in decisions for care. What's your best answer?
B.
Yes. B. Assist the family. So barriers to improving end-of-life care. What do we know about doctors? They don't want to fail. If I can't save you, I have failed, right? They're not God, okay? They're not miracle workers. They can only provide the best care possible, but they just want to keep trying everything that they possibly can. So they have difficulties in making a terminal prognosis, particularly with the ones who have the non-cancer diagnosis, the COPD, the heart failure, the cardiovascular, sick heart that's barely pumping. Advances in curative treatment options in late stage illness, financial pressures on healthcare providers that may cause them to retain rather than refer hospice eligible patients. Who pays for what? There's four levels of hospice care covered under Medicare and Medicaid. You've got the routine home care, all services provided at a daily rate. Inpatient respite care is a 5-day inpatient stay provided to give some relief to the caregivers. Continuous care, like care at home, management of medical crisis, which will revert back to home care after the crisis, and there's general inpatient care with an inpatient stay for symptom management that can't be provided at home. There used to be that if you were on hospice, you accepted the fact that you were going to die, but if something came up and you needed to go to the hospital, then your hospice stopped. That's not the case. Because there's a different payment for inpatient as is for a Medicare hospice for Medicare and Medicaid. So that comes down to the money. But now if, say, you're on hospice and you had to go in and have some passenger stretch bell broken or something like that, your hospice doesn't stop. Okay? Or if you have an infection and you need to go get some antibiotics, your hospice doesn't stop. You're still considered a hospice patient. You don't have to go back through the whole readmission process. They don't discharge you from the hospice and then have to readmit you to the hospice after you've been in the hospital for 3 days. So psychosocial issues, you need to be culturally aware and sensitive. to your patients if they want to talk about death. Conscious and practice cultural humility. You need to be aware of other, like the cultures in your community of where you're practicing. If you live in a community that's a big melting pot, how does the Asian population, Native American population, the Hispanic population, or any other country of the Muslim population, each has a different way that they view death with dignity. They don't all share the same traits. You have some that they're not gonna, if you go in there, they're gonna shut you down, they're gonna talk about it, we take what comes, that's it. We're not gonna talk about this. Family doesn't wanna talk about it. So your goal in communication is to create the shared understanding about that patient's values and their treatment preferences. Identified by patient family as one of the major improvements that's needed. Increase communication. Sometimes that encouraging communication between the patient and his family members. Now you're a therapist, right? Like, they want to talk about it. I don't want to talk about it. Well, y'all need to come to some understanding so that you can talk about it. Communication is tailored to the level of understanding. But we don't talk to our patients up here if our patient's level of understanding is down here. It's the same way with death. Right? It's no different than any other medical condition that they have. You develop the level of comfort and expertise for communicating with patients. Arrangements should be made to have the discussion at a time that's best for everyone. And document the discussions, document your advanced directives, document what your patient says to you, document what your patient's family member says to you, and educate. Become an effective listener. Resist the uncomfortable feeling of empty space. Gently prompt, do you need more time to think about this? Avoid distractions, avoid the impulse to give advice, and avoid the canned response, I know just how you feel. You do not know just how they feel unless you actually are in that situation. Because you can only know how that person feels. Unless you're in this room, and if anybody, and I'm sure we've all been detected, but when our loved ones have been told that they have cancer, did you feel like you got kicked in the stomach? Do you think you got kicked in the stomach as hard as the person that was told that they have cancer? I dare say you don't. So, we do not know how they feel. But we're going to listen. Let them talk. Let them cry. Let them rant. Let them be angry. Ask questions. Assess understanding, your own and your patient's. And give them hope. Let them know that you're going to be there for them. You don't want to discount them at any point. All right? Whatever you got going on can wait. If they need to talk, then you can find someone to say, I'm going to be in this room for a while. Can you listen for my patients? So, a patient who is dying wants to talk to the RN about fears of dying. The patient tells the RN, I know I'm dying, aren't I? So that's like a statement slash a question, right? What is the appropriate response for the nurse? This must be very difficult for you. Yes? No?
No.
Well, you're not going to say that to you. Tell me more about what's on your mind.
That sounds therapeutic.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I know exactly how you feel. That's enough. So we've narrowed it down. So it's definitely not A, and it's definitely not C. So we've got, tell me more about what's on your mind.
I said B, which is an answer.
Or, you know you're dying. Who says B?
That's it.
Who says D? Who's uncommittal? Because they thought that it was okay to ask him what's on your mind.
It was okay for the other ones. Yeah, on top of you, it was just B, but on here it says D.
Yeah. Yeah. We're supposed to say, you're dying. Yeah. So they acknowledge, they acknowledge what they know.
That's what it says on.
And then let them have the floor, right? You acknowledge it, okay?
So what is the appropriate nursing response, and what did y'all say the correct answer is?
So
on prep you, it says, tell me.
What's the discussion?
On prep you, it says what?
On prep you, it says, tell me more about what's on your mind.
I know, right? Everything that you just learned is like, you're supposed to say, tell me more about what's on your mind.
Right?
Not in this situation. In any other situation, I would have said, first is what you're supposed to say. But they say,
let me find the question on here.
Death and dying.
They're just supposed to say.
No. Now, you don't go in there and say that. No, you don't go and go. But, I mean,
you know
if he goes.
He says, I know I am dying.
Aren't I?
But he's asking you.
You ask that question, you go, you know you're dying. And then. Because then he can say what he knows. Okay, that's what you're trying to figure out, right? You're trying to figure out what exactly it is that he knows that says he's dying. And it may be because my doctor just told me I have X, Y, and Z and 6 months to live. He just wants to have you validated. He may just want to hear you say, I'm not going to get in, well, you've got 6 months left. I'm not getting into that part. I'll say, you do have this condition, and I'm just going to open the floor, okay? And then the awkward silence that everybody talks about, I'm going to let awkward silence stand. Comments, Alexandria, Nakish?
Okay.
I think the correct answer is everything's going to be okay.
It is a little different on prep you. It says, am I dying on prep you? It's not quite the same.
You know you're dying. But that's the point. You want to open up. You want to make them feel that it's okay to talk about it. No. Okay? Uh-huh. You're uncomfortable, aren't you? Because you know something. You know this about your patient. And this is, he's just been told all this. It's like, you're uncomfortable. Let me tell you what you're going to do. You know, when your patient's just got this, and you're going to find 5 to 10 other things to do, because you got 5 other patients, right? And each one of them are going to need 2 things each. And you're going to busy yourself because you're uncomfortable. And you know what? That's human nature. That's what we do. Because this is uncomfortable for us. But then you're going to have to go in the room and be there with them. And so you want to be prepared. This is the kind of thing that you prepare yourself for, right? So anyway, there's your explanation. It's important to ask questions, not to give advice. Spiritual care comes in a lot of different ways to a lot of different people. Spirituality is not just, isn't necessarily your religion or your religious beliefs. I live with a person whose spirituality takes place on a mountain, in a deer stand, in a boat, with a rod and reel, His spiritual world is out there in nature.
In a bar? Does that happen in a
bar?
Bar?
Mm-hmm. Yep, in a bar. It's different for everybody. It's that thing that gives them. Right, I want you to look at this definition. So spirituality includes, it's how a person derives meaning and purpose from life. It's their beliefs, their faith, their sources of hope. That source of hope, you know who the source of hope is for a lot of people? Their children, their friends, their family, and its attitudes towards death. So your spiritual assessment is faith and beliefs, importance and influence, community, and address and care. So managing your physiological responses, patient's goals should be direct care management, anticipating and planning interventions for symptoms is still the cornerstone of both palliative and end-of-life care. Pain, okay, preventable and treatable in most cases. You want to continue to do a pain assessment, patient and family. Should be treated right away. Delaying just makes it worse. I love this statement. The patient doesn't want to take morphine because he's afraid he's going to be addicted. This is the one time in your life where you need to take advantage of whether you get addicted or not. What's the difference? Right? Who cares? Who's going to judge you because now you're addicted to morphine? Not me.
And you, yep. you should partake in marijuana as well.
And that conversation did come up with my beloved most recently when I said, hey, are you going to use marijuana? Please use chemotherapy now. And he was like, I'm not going to smoke marijuana. I said, I didn't ask you to smoke marijuana. And then he says, okay, well, maybe I will do the gummies. Are you going to share one? No. Are you going to share your gummies? But anyway, but the thing is, if your patient says, you're not going to get addicted, okay? Even if he does, again, who cares? So this is not the time to worry about addiction. This is the time to relieve pain
how many
and make them comfortable, right? 37,
I think.
And they can get out.
So bad.
This is really important that you know, because this is how you know that it's imminent. It's the most prevalent symptom of end of life. And the treatment varies depending on the underlying cause. They also can have anxiety, fatigue, and insomnia. But at that point where it's most imminent, it will be difficulty breathing. It will be the Chain-Stokes breathing that you hear about, where you have the long periods of apnea, and then they'll have the increased breathing, and then they'll have the apnea. They'll be gasping. Chances are they've aspirated. That's what happened to my mom. She essentially had aspirated and developed aspiration pneumonia, and within 48 hours was gone. Ironically, at just a year younger, my grandmother, in the same place, same nursing home, did the exact same thing. Passed the exact same way, aspiration pneumonia. So, and it was very quiet and very, we were there. Any questions? Withdrawal of mechanical ventilation. All right, now, let's kind of switch gears a little bit. So I've gone from hospice and palliative care to the terminally ill to, say, gunshot wound to the head. Massive hemorrhage bleed. People who are not terminally ill, so to speak. All right? So there are certain criteria that's used when you withdraw mechanical ventilation. Now, this can cause serious issues in the hospital setting with family members when they don't agree with each other, what the loved one would want. So you gotta have a proactive approach, establish a time to initiate withdrawal, you talk to the family is a part of the decision process, okay? Remember that. Your patient can't be a part of the decision process. He's cognitively not able to, okay? You've established that his brain is not functioning anymore, okay? So, the family has to be a part of the decision process. You discontinue the medications and the monitors, and you discontinue all the medications, and then you just turn the machine off, and let the patient go, right? And it may happen immediately, and it may happen when it goes. Now, if you find yourself in a situation where you have a donor, all right? Now, that donor may have made that decision for everybody long time ago. Or a family may find themselves in a situation where they can make that decision. Not everybody's a donor. It is so hard to get a donor if you have, when it comes down to the vital organs. Okay? The brain has to have been viable for a period of time where that the organs have still had all the oxygen they needed and not damaged. So head wounds are in accidents where there's brain injury are your typical ones that end up being donors. Once there was the little 3-year-old boy who was in the boat with his grandpa, and he hit a cyclist and the boy hit his head, and he had a massive wound. His organs, his family made the decision to donate his organs to other children who were waiting for organs, so he saved lives. Man just had a massive cerebral hemorrhage, and the family acted very quickly, getting to the hospital, but his brain, they couldn't say, he was not going to ever be normal again. His family made the decision. Because of the age he was, we brought him to the cath lab and did a heart cath to see the status of his coronary arteries, to see if they were suitable to be donated, right? When you work in a place where all of them have, they're going to donate, teams are flown in, and they're all carrying their little, what is it called, the little igloos, the igloo cases, the little, their ice, what do you call them? Coolers, okay? Like you take to camping and stuff, but they have these little coolers, and they're all headed up to the OR, and they're each going to get whatever organ it is that they came for, and then they're going to fly back to where it is that they came from with their organs, okay, and with the patient. They can still have a funeral. Their loved one is still going to be intact. That's what the job of the logo is. So when you find yourself in a situation, if you work in an ER, anybody planning on working in an ER trauma? Okay, this is going to happen to you, okay? You're going to learn that you have to call logo when you have a patient. You do not approach the family for donation. Ever. That is LOFA's job. You just contact LOFA if they fit the criteria, and they'll say whether or not they're going to come and see the patient. And so they will approach the family. They take care of everything. The families pay for nothing when they donate as a part of that process. They do have the option of down the road, if they want to meet the families that got their loved ones' organs, they don't have to. Sometimes they do. But, like I said, you'll all be in service on LOFA even though you're 90-something-year-old patient that they knew was going to pass away, you still have to call LOFA and let them know that they died. And LOFA says, okay, thank you. They are notified of every death in Louisiana. What's the most common and feared responses to patients with a terminal illness?
Pain.
Nutrition and hydration, anorexia, this is like a lot of common. They don't want to eat, they don't want to drink. They may make the decision that they don't want to be artificially kept alive. They don't want to be artificially fed. So where they may agree to, giving them fluids, you're not going to put a stomach tube in them. If they decided, I don't want that, then yeah, the nursing home staff had an issue that we would not put a stomach tube in my mom, and I was like, she said, do not do any of that stuff to me. We just honored her wishes. They can give them medications to stimulate their appetite. They'll lose weight. The death vigil. The vigil has been defined as the act or state of being constantly attentive or keeping careful in response to signs of opportunity, activity, or danger. According to families, a vigil commenced is when there is an understanding that death is inevitable. They identified that the need to be close and were protective of personal time with their dying family member. I can tell you this, you know, in the time of COVID, that was my biggest fear, is that mom would die, and I was here, and she was there, and she was alone. But luckily, they notified us well in advance, and we were able to go and be with her for the time period before she, it was like a 6-hour period before she passed away, that we were all able to get there. And it's really important for some people, because even though you know what's happened, it's just important that you don't get that phone call and say, we're sorry, they're gone. It's just not the phone call that I wanted to get. As death nears, the patient may withdraw, sleep for longer periods, become somnolent, and it may take hours and it may take days. It's generally preceded by some or all of the following: increased intervals between respirations, that's what we know as the chain Stokes, a weakened or irregular pulse, diminished blood pressure, skin color changes or mottles. She was very cold. It was like all of her, everything was like going towards the heart and her lungs at the time, and she was like very, very cold. Confusion, restlessness, congestion, she had the death rattle. Decreased urinary output, decreased intake.
Okay.
So death is when all vital organs and body systems irreversibly cease to function. Brain death is defined as complete irreversible cessation of function of entire brain and brain stem, regardless of presence of beating heart. Pupils are non-reactive. Absence of the response to the cold chloric reflex is where they put cold saline in the ear canal to get a response. No call for gag reflex, apnea challenge. Ventilator support required for the vital organ function. Spinal reflexes may continue. There's spontaneous flexion, extension may be noted. Aftercare. Nursing care continues. We prepare the body. There's certain guidelines that have to be adhered to based on your policy. You may keep all the tubes in until the nursing, if it's in the hospital, until the funeral home gets there, or it may be something that has to be till the coroner gets there. Cultural rituals are allowed. Positioning, bathing by healthcare, dressing, rigor mortis, around 2 to 7 hours post-death. Cultural rituals. If you ever find yourself working with Native American population, they have very rigid guidelines. I've had a few patients that had spontaneous abortions in the emergency room, and they were be on the phone with the elders getting the instructions that we, the nurses, would have to adhere to for that fetus, because they wanted it to take it to their area for the proper burial of the fetus. So just be very conscious of all situations. This, you know, labor delivery, you know, labor delivery people? Anybody? Okay. You too, fetal demise. Okay, you're gonna find yourself in situations with parents, NICU nurses, organ donation. I guess I've already talked about enough. The representatives will address the families, not nurses. Now, if a family approaches you, then you'll say, I will contact the people. You know, if they say they're gonna think about donation. Grief, mourning, and bereavement. Grief is the personal feelings that accompany an anticipated or actual loss. Mourning refers to the individual, group, family, cultural expressions of grief and associated behaviors. What was one of the oldest associated behaviors of a woman whose husband died? Y'all remember what it was? Had to wear black for one entire year. That's how you knew a woman was in mourning, was that her husband had died, is that she wore black for one entire year. Bereavement refers to the period of time during which mourning takes place. So, bereavement can be, it's like you get bereavement leave if someone, certain people pass away when you're working. So, bereavement can last for as long as, you know, that family member, the loved one needs it. Okay? Grief changes shape, but it never ends. And y'all know about Kubler Ross's stages of grief, anger, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. Bereavement care is everybody's responsibility. You know how many of you will take care of a patient that will pass away that you will show up at their wake?
That's it.
And their funeral? Because some patients you will take care of over and over, that you will become close friend, you'll feel like family, and you have no idea what it will mean to have those people at your loved one's services, even if they just come by. Communication that's timeless, honest, and empathetic is an integral part of supporting those who are in bereavement. There is a nursing diagnosis, grief. And the interventions are support, expression of feelings, assess social support, assess the coping skills, assess for signs of complicated grief and mourning, offer professional referral. The goal is to verbalize feelings regarding potential and actual loss. The patient will develop appropriate coping skills. At that time, that patient might be the family, not necessarily the patient. Sometimes the person who gets forgotten about is the spouse of the patient who've been married over 50, 60 plus years, and they really do not want to go on after that person has passed. And so it's very important that family members are aware of where they are emotionally, because they get depressed very, very easy. Because they're lost. You know, they've been together their whole entire lives and they can't imagine a day without them. So be very supportive of the elderly in their loss. You know, sometimes they give that stiff upper lip and they're really not. And there's support for you if you're going to work with these kinds of patients. You know, some people don't think about working in hospice at this point. You may say, I'm only going to work in CCU, I'm going to work in ICU, I'm going to work in the ER. And there may come a time after your first 15 years where you go, you know what, I think I want something a little more less intense. I think I'm going to go. Hospice is a good place to go. Okay? It makes you feel good at the end of the day. But take care of yourself. This is important for anything. But for those when you work in the hospice settings, they do take care of each other. Like I said, they're interdisciplinary, so there's always a social worker that's on staff, there's a chaplain that's on staff. And think about your own feelings of death. In education, most nurses have no formal training in death and dying, other than this brief lecture. That's it. Any questions?
No questions here.
I'm turning off the recorder.
Okay, real quick, okay? I want to